Hey, you're tuned in to the Verve Podcast live from the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks for listening, and viva la Verve!
So, hey, I want to get you thinking about the greatest rivalries of all time. You know, like two competitors who seem to be always going at it, and the competition's so fierce, you had to choose just one. Like in sports, in basketball, you've got the Lakers versus the Celtics for years, Magic versus Bird. In football, you've got Tom Brady versus Peyton Manning, or Tom Brady versus Roger Goodall. Some of you know sports, yeah. College basketball, North Carolina, Duke, Michigan, Ohio State, and college football. Then outside of sports, there's the Hatfields versus the McCoys. There's Coke versus Pepsi. How many of you are Coke? God will forgive you. He's a God of grace. You're wrong. It's okay. Iraq versus Iran. There was Aaron Burr versus Alexander Hamilton, which Burr killed Hamilton, so he seemed to have the edge, but Hamilton got the Broadway show, so I guess he won, I think. So I looked up online most famous rivalries, and the number one at the very top of the list was sperm whale versus giant squid. But did I miss something? Apparently I've missed some segment of history. I don't know. So last week we started a new 2-week series, which if you're doing math means it ends today. By the way, next week we are starting a brand new series. I am psyched about this one. It's called Flip the Script. And what we're going to talk about are common lies that we believe about ourselves and believe about life that limit our potential, that keep us stuck. And we're going to learn how to embrace God's truth in those specific areas so that we can get unstuck and really move into the future. I think it's a can't-miss series. But this week, we're concluding this series on hope. We all need hope. We can't live without hope. We need to put our hope in something. Question is, what will we put our hope in? And will it come through for us? Last week, we looked at a bunch of different options of what people do put their hope in, and we decided the most sensible thing to do is to put your hope in God, that He's the only option that can give you enduring joy, even when everything else goes wrong, and that you can be sure will not disappoint you in the end. If you missed last week, you could listen to it or watch it on the Verve app or online. Today, I want to look at God's greatest competition, God's greatest rival when it comes to what we put our trust in, what we put our hope in. And it's ironic because our money says, in God we trust, but God's greatest rival when it comes to what we trust is money. It's our money. There's a passage in the Bible in a book called 1 Timothy that talks all about how we need to put our hope in God and this temptation we all feel to put our hope in money. So if you have a Bible, we're going to look through that passage today. If you have a Bible, you can turn to 1 Timothy or a Bible app. If you don't have it, fine. We're going to put all the verses on the screen. And if you don't own an easy-to-read translation of the Bible, we give them out for free at the Velcro Bar, which is our connecting place. So if you'd like to meet someone today, if you'd like to sign up for something, if you have questions, or if you want a free Bible, stop by the Velcro Bar, and we would love to give you one. So one of the early Christian leaders was a guy named Paul, and he wrote this letter to one of the people he was mentoring, a guy named Timothy. Timothy was in charge of a church, kind of like ours, and Paul gives Timothy all kinds of instructions for leading the church and leading people, and there are some specific instructions for what to do with rich people. Apparently, there were some rich people in that church who didn't know how to be rich. Some had attitudes of superiority, and they were kind of looking down on other people. Some overindulged while ignoring the needs of other people right around them. Some made poor decisions because they kind of felt like they were above the rules. For Paul, the problem was not that they were rich. The problem was that they didn't know how to be rich. And so he gives Timothy instructions to give them on how to be rich. So we're going to be in 1 Timothy chapter 6, starting in verse 17. We're going to read the passage, and then we'll go back through it a little by little. Okay? Starts out in verse 17 like this. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. So, Paul starts with this phrase. He says, command those who are rich. And my question is, who is he talking about? Who's rich? And probably most of us would all answer the same way. We'd all say, someone else, right? Not me. Someone who makes more than me. I don't know who's rich, but I know they make more than me and have more than me. What's interesting is that the definition of rich turns out to be quite fluid. It turns out it changes based on how much you make and how much you have. There was a survey done not long ago, and they asked people, how much money would you need to consider yourself rich? How much does a rich person make every year? What's rich? Look at the results. In households making under $25,000 a year, the average response for what it would take to be rich was $293,000 a year. That's the income. In households earning between $30,000 and $60,000, the number went up to $394,000 a year. In households earning between $60,000 and $120,000, the number went up to a salary of $426,000 a year. And for those earning over $120,000, the number went up to over $500,000. Do you see a pattern? Right? No one thinks they're rich because being rich means having more. That's what rich is. It's more. It's more than I have. But what's the truth? Well, like if we could try to define what really is rich today, well, here are some more numbers. Listen to this. If your household income is more than $1,500 a year, you are in the top 25% of richest people in the world. Okay, 75% of the people in the world make less and have less than you. And God, when he looks at the world, looks at the world, right? He doesn't just look at your neighborhood, he looks at the world. If your household income is more than $25,000 a year, congratulations, you are in the top 10% of the richest people in the entire world. If your household income is more than $50,000 a year, you are in the top 1% of the richest people in the world. What does that mean? It means that I'm rich. And that feels so weird. Like it makes me uncomfortable to say that sentence. And I'm pretty sure it also means that you are rich. You are rich. Now, what should have happened just now is we all should have started yelling, yeah, woo! Like that's all, everyone wants to be rich. I didn't know, I'm rich, you're rich, we're all rich. Like we should be jumping up and down and slapping fives because we found out we're rich. Who doesn't want to be rich? But I'm guessing that's not how you're feeling right now, right? You're probably not excited. You're probably more confused, right? Like, what? Huh? You're confused, right? Do you know why? Because rich people don't feel like they're rich. Rich people never feel like they're rich. There's no person in the world who's like, yes, nobody thinks you're rich. Rich is always more, right? I'll tell you, I remember my first job. My first job was picking grapes from a vineyard. It sounds like, you know, Grapes of Wrath book or something like that. That was my first job. And I got my first ever paycheck. It was probably like $40. I felt like the richest person I was like, I got $40. What's ironic is that ever since that first paycheck, I have made increasingly more and more, but my entire life I have continually felt like I had less. Why? It's not because I had less, I've had more. It's because I become more and more aware of other people who have more than me. Right? It's because the more I have, the more I become aware of other people who have more. And so I feel like I have less. And I focus not on what I have, but on what I don't have. This is why when I hear Paul say, command those who are rich, I don't think he's talking about me. I'm like, I can skip this part, right? He must be talking to someone who has more. The truth is, Paul is talking to me. And I'm guessing that Paul is talking to you. If you make a couple thousand a year, you are rich. Okay? Paul's talking to you. Even if, for some reason, you can't accept that right now. If you're like, I'm not buying it, doesn't make sense to me. Okay. How about this? Just for now, let's just proceed the next half hour like we're the ones that Paul's talking to. He is. You are rich. But if you want to be wrong, you can be wrong. That's okay with me. But let's just pretend that we're all rich and he's talking to us, okay? So what does he say to people like us? He starts out, he says, command. We're going to go right back through that passage. He says, command those who are rich not to be arrogant. Notice what he doesn't say. He does not say we should feel guilty about being rich. He doesn't say that it's sinful to be rich. No, he says, command those who are rich not to be arrogant. Why? Because one of the things money does is it tempts you to believe things about yourself that are not entirely true. You start to believe that you're smarter than other people. You start to believe that you're more entitled than other people. You start to believe that your time matters more than other people's. You start to believe that your comfort is more important than other people's. Question, have you ever seen money change a person? Anyone ever see money change? We all have, right? Here's what's funny. We refuse to believe that that person might be us. Right? We think money changes people, other people. Money hasn't changed us. Did you know that there's all kinds of research that actually proves money really does change people? For example, studies have proven that having more money decreases your compassion for other people. Get this. There is a job, some people have a job, where what they do for a living is study other people playing Monopoly. That's a job. That's a weird job, right? But they do studies. So here's one study they do. They'll have two people compete in a game of Monopoly, but they start out the two players with vastly unequal amounts of money. And what happens every time is that the person who gets more money says, well, this isn't fair. And they feel guilty and this is wrong. But as the game goes on, they stop feeling awkward about having more and start being a jerk about having more. Some of you have played with that Monopoly player, right? They start going, you owe me 400, you land on Park Place, right? They stop feeling weird because I have so much more than you, and they start to feel kind of jerky about it. Here's another study. Another study was done at a pedestrian crosswalk where the law requires cars to stop and let the pedestrians walk across the street. What kind of cars do you think were the least likely to let people cross? Expensive luxury cars or less expensive cars? Yeah, turns out drivers of expensive luxury cars were 4 times less likely to stop for pedestrians. Why? Why would that be? Money changes people. It does. It goes to your head. It creates a sense of entitlement. You start to think you deserve it. You're a little better than, a little bit more important than other people. That's just what happens to rich people. And we're rich people. We're the rich people. Paul continues in helping Timothy know what to teach people like us who are rich. He says, command those who are rich not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth. And here's where we get to the rivalry, right? Right up there with Alabama Auburn in college football, with Apple IBM in computers, with sperm whale versus giant squid in aquatic marine life. I don't know. It is the competition for our trust. What will we put our hope in? God or money? God's greatest rival for most people when it comes to what we put our hope in, what we put our trust in, it tends to be money. That's what the Bible says. And that's especially true for us rich people. The more money we have, the more tempted we become to just place our hope in it, to start thinking, I'm pretty sure that if I get enough of this, I'm going to have security. I'm going to have contentment. I'm going to have joy. I'm going to have safety. I'm going to have protection. I'm going to be satisfied. I like how the Bible talks about this in a book called Proverbs, because it gives kind of a picture. It says, the wealth of the rich is their fortified city. They imagine it, their wealth, a wall too high to scale. It's an interesting picture. In other words, the rich imagine that their money is going to make them safer, more secure. So what do? Well, they realize they need to get more of it to increase their wall. And so they work longer hours, even if that means their relationships suffer. They make choices at work that maybe they're a little bit ashamed of, but it got them extra money. That they cling to their resources. They refuse to really be generous, right? This is why people who make more, the more they make, the smaller of a percentage that they give away. That's a proven fact. It's been proven a bunch of times. But why? You would think the more you make, the more you could afford to give, because you still have tons to live off of. That's not the way it works. And the reason? Because the more you have, the more you think you need. Because the more you have, you think you can build for yourself an unscalable wall so that you can become totally secure. No more worries in life. No more what ifs, because I've got a bank account, my savings, right? Check out this verse in the Bible, Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 10. Says, whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. Here's what's interesting about this verse. If I said to you, hey, who loves money? I bet you almost no one would raise their hand. If I said, hey, who loves wealth? I bet almost no one would raise their hand. But if I said, hey, who feels like you just never really have enough money? I bet most, maybe all of us would be like, yeah, that's me. How many of you like are just not really satisfied right now with your current level of income? I bet most of us would probably raise our hands and say, yeah, that's me. And what this verse says is, that means we love money. That means we love wealth. What this means is that when I have the feeling that I don't have enough money or I'm not satisfied with my current level of income, that is not necessarily a sign that I actually don't have enough. It is a sign that I love money and I have put my hope in wealth. There's a pastor named Andy Stanley. He asked a great question of his church, and it hit me. I thought we should wrestle with it as well. He asked this, we'll put it on the screen. He said, how much money would you need to secure your future against all imaginable eventualities? Get it? Like, how much money would you need so that you'd feel like, okay, I'm safe. I'm secure. Like, I don't have to worry anymore. Do you know what the answer is? More. No matter how much you have, I promise you the answer is more. For every person, the answer is more than I currently have. See, your money isn't the problem. What you believe about your money is the problem. The problem is when we start to count on our money, when we start to cling to our money, when we start to put our hope in it. Like you start to think that it can secure your future, but I promise you'll never get there. There will never be a day where you go, okay, got it. I have enough. I'm going to be okay. You will always, always feel like you need more. You know, it's interesting. As a pastor, I've had a bunch of times where I have spent time with someone on their deathbed, like someone who's got hours left, someone who's got a day or two left, lots of times. And they always say the same things for the most part. Here's what I have never heard once. No one has ever said, "I just wish I had more money." Never. No one has ever said to me, "And looking back, I wish I made more money." Never. I've never heard that or anything like it. Why? Because money can do some things for you. But one thing it cannot do is it cannot provide security. We think it can, but it can't. And when you get to the end of your life and you have a pastor visit you on your deathbed and you talk to him about your life, I promise you, you will not wish that you put your hope in money. And you're not going to wish you had made more money. And I realize probably for a lot of us, most of us are youngish. And so we can't even imagine. I can't even imagine being on my deathbed. Like that's just, okay, what about this week? What about this week? Think about what's most important in life and what money cannot do for you. It cannot fix a relationship. It can't mend a marriage that's on the rocks. It can't change the heart of a loved one or a child who's against you. It can't heal you of an addiction or from loneliness or from despair. You know, the truth is some of you make more money than you ever have in your life right now, and you're not any happier. And the irony is you still think if I had made more money, I'd finally be happy. Some of you have more stuff than you ever thought you would, but you still are stressed and anxious about life. Money isn't the problem. Putting our hope in money, that's the problem. So what should we do? That's the next part of what Paul commands Timothy to command rich people. He says this. He says, command those who are rich. Again, sorry, but that's us. Or yay, that's us. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. So Paul knows your heart. He knows my heart. He knows why we're always striving to have more. It's because you and I, you were made to be content. You were made to be satisfied. You were made to have joy. And so you need something to put your hope in for those things. And Paul says, man, put your hope in God. You know, I said a minute ago, I said, the problem isn't your money. The problem is what you believe about your money. The problem is also what you believe about God. Not what you tell yourself you believe about God or you say you believe about God, but what, like, deep down you really actually believe about God. It's that maybe, deep down, where you don't like to admit it, you don't talk about it, maybe deep down, you don't think he really cares. Maybe deep down, you don't believe he's really reliable. Maybe deep down, you don't believe that he richly provides you with everything you need. I'm not saying it's easy. Just so you, I want to make sure you... It's not easy. It's not easy to trust. It's not. In fact, it may feel risky to you to put your hope in God. And it certainly, I think, feels easier to just put our hope in money. But let me ask you this. So on a scale of 0 to 10, how much does your money care about you? How many of you said 0? Some of you didn't. We could talk later if you want. The answer is 0. Okay? It is, right? Your money is not sad when you're sad. It doesn't weep when you weep. It doesn't care if there's a lot of it in your bank account or just a little. It doesn't care if it stays in your bank account or ends up in someone else's bank account. Your money does not care about you. Okay, now, on a scale of 0 to 10, how much does God care about you? 10. The answer is 10. But even if you're not sure, and you might not be, if we get so many people who are like, I'm not sure about this God thing. That's awesome. Maybe you're like, right now, if I'm just being honest, I feel like 2. I would put God cares about me 2, maybe 4. Okay, but wouldn't you be better off trusting and putting your hope in someone who at least cares about you a little, right? Wouldn't you be better off trusting someone who knows all of your needs? Wouldn't you be better off trusting someone who chose to have his son come and die for you? Wouldn't you be better off trusting someone who is at least not a 0? Paul's not telling us to choose less security. Like that might be how it feels. You might be kind of rattling this around your brain and thinking, if I really did this, if I put my hope in God, not money, I'd have less security in life because, you know, putting my hope in money is what makes me feel secure. No, Paul is not asking us to choose less security. He's saying you need to choose more security. You need to be more secure. You need the kind of security that counts. You need the kind of a security that will be there for you when you are on your deathbed. Money won't. You need the kind of security that's eternal, that sticks with you after your deathbed. And Paul is saying, do the financially wise thing. Choose more security by putting your hope not in money, but in God. And here's the thing. I think maybe I need to make this clear. Like, you have to choose. Like, it's not like, okay. Like, you actually have to choose. You have to answer the question. We'll put it on the screen. Will I put my trust in my riches, or will I put my trust in the God who richly provides? Will I put my trust in my riches or in the God who richly provides? And the hard news, the news that stinks, I don't like it either, is you can only choose one. That's not the way most of us live. I get it. It's like, I trust God. I believe in God. I put my hope in God. And I also put my hope in money. You can't. Jesus said that real clear. Matthew 6:24, he said, you cannot serve both God and money. You have to choose, and you can only choose one. So you might be asking, what does that look like then? Like, so let's say I chose money. What does that look like? That's exactly what Paul addresses next in his letter. He says, command them. Who's he talking about? Rich people. Who's rich people? We are. Yeah. No, we're still not excited about that? No. He says, command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age. He's talking about in the year 3000. He's talking about like after this life, eternal life, that age. So that, he says, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. Let's read that again. He says, command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. Man, you want to take hold of the life that is truly life, right? We all do that. That's the life we were made for. That's the life that we long for. That's the life that we think, if I just had more money, I'd get it. And Paul says, no, do you really want to take hold of that life? Do you want to know how to take hold of that life? Do you want to know how to be really rich? Really secure? He says, here's how. He says, put your hope in God. And he says, for rich people, he says, here's how you do that. By doing good, being generous, and being willing to share your money. He says, that's what it looks like for rich people like us. It's simple. I'm not saying it's easy. I don't think it's easy. But the answer to this question is simple. He says, if you want to take hold of the life that is truly life, if you want that contentment, if you want that joy, if you want that security, if you want that peace, here's how you do it. Put your hope in God, not money. Here's what it looks like. You do good, you give, you're generous and willing to share your money. And people who actually live that way, you sit down with them and talk to them, they'll tell you it is such a better life. Such a better life. this idea, the idea of being generous with your money and giving, it may be new to you. It may sound crazy. Or maybe for some of you, like, it sounds interesting. It sounds scary. It's a little scary, but kind of cool. I'm intrigued, but I don't know where to start, right? Like if this is new to you, like when anything's new to you, it's like, well, I don't know how to start, right? It's like, okay, so God says be generous and willing to share. That's how you grab a hold of life. That's what it looks like to put your hope in me. But what does that look like? Where do I start? God actually answers that question all through the Bible. He actually talks about the answer to that question more than he talks about any other thing in the entire Bible. So all the way back, starting in the very first book of the Bible, Genesis, God talks about giving away 10% of whatever you bring in. The Bible calls giving the first 10%, kind of slicing that off. That's generosity. It calls it tithing. The word tithing, literally, the word tithe literally means tenth. A tithe literally is a tenth. So tithing means tenthing. So the idea is you slice off the first 10% and you give that away. According to God, that's the starting point of generosity. And he says that dozens and dozens of times. Here's one example. Leviticus chapter 27, verse 30 says, a tenth of all you produce is the Lord's and is holy. All through the Old Testament, which is the part before Jesus came in the Bible, over and over and over and over and over and over and over, give a tenth, that's generosity, give a tenth. Then Jesus shows up, and Jesus comes along and reinforces that teaching in Matthew 23, 23. He said, yes, you should tithe. You should tenth off the first tenth. And he says, and you shouldn't leave the more important things undone either. Then, throughout the rest of the New Testament, people are told a bunch of times, now that Jesus has come for us and died for us, we should give generously to God. The new standard is give generously. So the New Testament was written almost entirely to people who had been taught tithing, tenthing, their entire lives. And they had done it. They had tithed their entire lives. So obviously, when they were encouraged to give generously, they could not possibly have thought that that meant giving less than 10%. Like 10% was normal, and they're told, now that Jesus died for you, let's give generously. So they would have thought, well, obviously I'm being encouraged to consider maybe giving more than 10%. I understand how this sounds if you're new to this. Right now, you're probably, your brain's going, gah! Ooh! Ooh! Right? It's just like, whoa, man. And I understand, because that's how I reacted the first time I heard about this. I did not grow up in church, never went. In my 20s, started reading the Bible, came to faith, and I hit this idea that I'm supposed to give 10% and live off of 90%, and I reacted the same way you might be reacting. The reason I did is because I believed in money more than I believed in God. That's why I reacted that way. But the truth is, at that time, my hope was in money, not in God. But man, I desperately, as someone who was putting my faith in Jesus and committing to give my life to God, follow Jesus, I desperately wanted to be someone who really believed in God and not, who didn't put his faith in money, put his faith in God. And so I did it. Like literally the first week I was a Christian, from that week on, the rest of my life, whatever I brought in, somebody gave me a birthday present. Hey, here's $50 for your birthday. Paychecks, everything I've ever gotten since the first day I became a Christian, the first tenth, I said, I'm going to give that to God. And even though it was hard, okay, like my first job, I was married, my income, my annual income was $9,600. Like that was our family income. And I said, I'm going to give at least 10% of that to God. It wasn't like, man, I got so much money, I could give 10% and roll in the rest. Like I was like, whoo, this is going to be hard. But I did. I said, I'm going to do this. And I treated it like a starting point, because that's what the Bible says. It's the starting point of generosity. So over the years, as I've made more, I've just continually just bumped up the percent little by little by little over the years. Like it didn't make any sense to me that I had more than I used to, but that I would still give the same percentage that I used to. It didn't make any sense to me that I made more than other people did, but I would give the same percentage as they did. So over the years, I've just continually tried to bump up my percentage little by little. And remember, like I freely admit, the first time I heard this, I thought it was crazy, maybe like you, but here's what's happened in my life. Over the years, what I have learned is that God is trustworthy. He is trustworthy. Somehow, I kept having more by keeping less. God has richly provided me with everything I've needed, just like He promised. And I want to encourage you, as rich people, like we read here, to consider being generous and willing to share. Now, you don't have to. Okay, let's just be clear about that. I'm not telling you you have to. No one can tell you you have to. No one is going to make you do this. But God has asked you to do this, right? God tells you dozens of times to be generous and willing to share, and that the beginning point of generosity is to slice off that first 10% of your income to be generous with. You don't have to. Okay? You don't have to. But the one thing I just think is clear is that if you don't, if God says you need to give 10%, and you look him in the eye and say, no, then you have to face the fact that you have put your hope in money, not God. I don't say that to be confrontational. I'm not trying to be a jerk. Get to know me. I'm really nice. You'll love me. I'm awesome. I'm kind of kidding. Kind of not. I'm pretty nice. I'm not trying to be a jerk. I'm just saying it's an obvious truth, right? If God says, and he said this, I can show you dozens of times. If he says, listen, what you have, you only have because I've given it to you. You might say, I have it because I worked hard and I was smart. Yeah, who allowed you to work hard and be smart? Okay, what you have is because he's given it to you. He says that. And he says, and actually, it's not your money. God says, it's my money. I'm just letting you use it. I'm asking you to hold it and be trustworthy with it. And if God says, I'm actually giving you more than you need, and the reason is so that you'll be generous and share with other people and contribute to the mission that is at my very heart. And if God says, the beginning point of that generosity is you need to give me back at least 10%, and you hear all that and you say, no. No, God. I will not do that. Okay, but you can't say that you're putting your hope in God. You just can't, right? If you put your hope in God, well, then you would do whatever he tells you to do with your money. If you put your hope in money, you very well might not do what God says to do with your money. And so you have to do what you choose with this, but just you just have to recognize, I have not put my hope in God. And that might explain some things. Like maybe you come to church, you read Bible verses, you hear us talking about, you know, when you know Jesus, you have more joy. Maybe you think, I don't feel like I do have more joy. You'll have this peace in your life. I don't know that I do have peace. You'll have this confidence in a better future. I don't know if I have it. Why don't I have it? I come to church, I believe in God. Maybe it's because you have not put your hope in God. Paul says the way you grab onto the life that is really life is you put your hope in God. And what that looks like for rich people, do good, be generous, willing to share. Maybe, and again, it's up to you. Like, in fact, the Bible says don't give under compulsion. So if you feel like, all right, I'm going to do it just because you're making me, you're telling, you know, you whatever, then don't. But maybe you do need to consider doing what God says with your money. I know it's scary. I get it. But did you know that this is the only thing in the entire Bible that God says to test him on? Like with everything else, God says, don't test me. But with this one thing, probably because he knew how scary it would be for us, God says, test me. Let's check it out. Malachi chapter 3, verse 10. God speaking, he says, bring the whole tithe, the whole 10% into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. Test me in this, says the Lord Almighty, and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing that there will not be room enough to store it. God says, bring the whole tithe, the whole 10%. He says, into the storehouse. If you read Bible scholars and commentators, it would say, he's talking about into his church, into his mission. God says, test me in this. Test me and see if I won't bless you. I will bless you. And that's what I've experienced. Here's what I would encourage you. God, it's the only thing God says, test me on. Why don't you test him on it? Like, actually do that. Like he asked you to. So like, what about this? What if, and we'll help you actually, we'll help you. What if you do a tithe challenge? You are going to test God, okay, for let's say 3 months. For 3 months, you're gonna test God, and if you feel, you're by tithing, okay? I'm gonna tithe for just 3 months as a test against God, and if you don't feel like God has blessed you, then we'll just give you all the money that you gave back. I mean it. Now, you have to give online or through check, so we have a record of your giving, okay? If you come in and say, I've given like $1 million in cash and I'd like that back, please, I'm going to be like, dude, get out of here, right? Nobody gave $1 million in cash. But if we have a record of your giving and you come in and you say, Vince, like I gave, that was a full 10%. I did what God said and he did not bless me. I do not feel blessed. I would like my money back, please, because you said it would happen. He said it, God said it would happen. It didn't happen. Then we'll write you a check for everything you gave back. I mean it. Do you know why I'm so confident in making that offer? Because I know God will bless you. Like there's no fear in that for me. Some of you know that because if you've been tithing, you're like, yep, I would never ask for it back, and I would never go back because my life is way more blessed. My life is way more better because of giving. In fact, maybe some of us are like, man, I've been so blessed by being generous. I wonder like how I could be a little bit more of a blessing. I could be a little bit more generous. And so, I don't know, maybe you think about growing your percentage. Maybe you say, maybe it's time for me to just bump up the percentage a little. Or it might be, you know what, I'm going to sponsor one of the Compassion Kids. We've got a ton of people here who sponsor kids in Ecuador. Maybe you're like, hey, how do I do that? I can give, what is it, 30, 40 bucks a month? I can do that. Or maybe it's becoming a foster parent in your home. Who else can I bless? I want to give more. Do you know what's fascinating? People who give more and more live on less and less, but they feel rich. They feel satisfied. They feel content. They feel joy. They better understand like why they're here, what their purpose in life is, why they've been given all this stuff they've been given. And here's what I have never heard anyone say. I've never heard any generous person say, I wish I hadn't. I wish I hadn't given so much. I wish I didn't make the sacrifices I had to make. Never, not once. So as we end this series, this little short series, here's the question. Where's your hope? What have you put your hope in? Maybe this morning made you realize kind of deep down, and I've been there, I know, that, man, I didn't think about it like walking in, but like, I think my hope is in riches, not in the God who richly provides. That's the beautiful thing about a new day, right? Today could be the day you decide I am moving my hope. I am choosing to put my hope in God. And Paul says, as a rich person, that might look like a decision to tithe. It might be how you respond to people in need that you see. It might be how you approach your work, how you approach your paycheck. It might be what you buy, what you don't buy. Where is your hope? Where is your hope? And we need hope to live. And you are going to put your hope in something. So put your hope in God. You know, when I think about all this, that I can't not think about Jesus. Because if you think about Jesus, he had all the resources of the universe at his disposal, right? He was God's own son. He had for all eternity been all powerful, had all the resources of the world. And what did he choose to do with it? He emptied himself. He came down. He lived in the form of a man. He was generous with his time. Anything he had, he shared it with those in need. He was never about himself. And ultimately, he chose to go to a cross so we could have life. He was generous and poured himself out. How could he do that? His hope was in God. And so we're going to give you a little bit of time to think about this. And I hope that you might decide this morning, I'm going to put my hope in God. While we do this, the band's going to play a song where you have a chance to pray. And we have communion available on the tables around the room. And communion is a piece of bread and a cup of juice that remind us of Jesus' body and blood given for us on the cross. And it's a way that we can thank him for his generosity and we can recommit ourselves to him and the commitment that he's made to us. So if you'd like to take communion, you can get up during the song, get it, and bring it back to your seat. And when you're ready, you can take that. So let me pray for you, and then we'll give you this song to pray and think about where you want to put your hope. God, as we talked about last week, there are lots of options of where we'll... Some of us put our hope in love. We think, if I just find the right boyfriend, the right girlfriend, the right spouse, then I'll be happy and secure and satisfied and joyful. Some of us put it in popularity or success or power. You tell us that for most of us, the greatest temptation is to put our hope in money and the things it can buy. God, help us to put our hope in you. It's not easy. There's so many things pulling at us. Help us to put our hope in you, God. And I think about Jesus. He put his hope, he put his trust in us when he came down and he emptied himself and he died on a cross hoping that we would put our faith in him. Thank you for Jesus. And putting our hope in you is the only thing that's going to get us through this life and where we want to be in the next one. God, help us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.